You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 13th of May, 2024, on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's programme... Protests in Georgia are reaching a boiling point over a foreign agent's law that critics call the Russia bill and risks EU membership. We'll have the latest from Tbilisi. After that, Vladimir Putin has replaced his defense minister in the middle of his military launching another major offensive in Ukraine. We'll ask why. Then we'll head to Stockholm for a summit of Nordic leaders and Germany. And finally, speaking of the Nordics, we welcome back Fernando Augusto Pacheco, fresh off a trip to Malmo. What were you ever doing there, Faye?
Hello, Chris. I was there covering my main event of the year, Eurovision, of course.
All of that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. It has been almost 10 years since protesters in Kyiv's Maidan Square forced Ukraine's government to abandon its Russian-friendly stance in favor of an association agreement with the European Union. Over the weekend, tensions boiled over for similar reasons in another Russian neighbor, Georgia. Some 50,000 people surrounded the country's parliament, waving Georgian, Ukrainian, and EU flags in an effort to stop passage of a foreign agent's law that not only cracks down on press and civic freedoms in the country, but could complicate its path to European Union membership. Well, Georgi Tabagari is a civic activist and director of Tbilisi Pride. He joins us now from Georgia to discuss the weekend's events. Georgi, thanks very much for coming on the program. Tell us, first of all, about the weekend and what you experienced.
Thanks very much for hosting. And a small correction, it was around 150,000 people consistently, basically, in the past couple of days, protesting in Tbilisi. On 11th was the large organized protest that took place, which was a bit of a warning to ruling Georgian Dream government not to proceed with the proposed Russian bill. But as we saw this morning, it took only over 60 seconds, basically, like to adopt in the committee this bill, and they are completely neglecting still the large scale protests that are happening in Tbilisi, directly stating that they are ready to do whatever it takes to pass this law. And we are experiencing a lot of crackdowns, persecution. Yesterday, on the weekend, on Saturday, we woke up in the reality when a lot of critical voices have been targeted. For instance, they visited my father's place, who is 77 years old, and vandalized my car and targeted basically in the surrounding and put up the posters to discredit the critical voices who are a part of the protests. So this is all like similar methods that usually Russia employs and have been employed in the past. And they've done the same, and they are doing it in Kyiv and all over the places where the Kremlin basically has the interest. So we are having a classic Kremlin hybrid operation happening in Georgia in parallel to the war in Ukraine, which aims at capturing the Georgian state, basically. And we are experiencing this at the moment in Georgia.
Georgi, you described the determination there of the Georgian government, the sort of Russian tactics that are being used to crack down on these protests. It does feel like there is an equal determination on the side of the protesters. So, I mean, there is, as you say, this bill has gone through committee. There will be a final vote tomorrow. What will the next 24 hours look like in your mind?
The protests are not going to stop. This is definitely, you can feel it despite the fear mongering and all this terror that we were experiencing in the past couple of days, and the arrests that are followed as well. It's not going to crack down. Georgia is not Belarus. Georgia is not Russia. We have 35 years of freedom and independence, and it's not going to go as easy as possibly Georgian government and Kremlin people are expecting. People are having stamina. There is young generation in Georgia. If for the listeners and the audience, just we all thought that the Gen Z was the fragile generation, but what is happening in Georgia is that young generation is in the front line and fighting against the system, and this is absolutely mind-blowing. And I think there is no way that it's either we survive this or we lose independence. So and I believe that the people are going to fight until the end.
When you mentioned Gen Z there, that was also the group that sort of led protests in Ukraine, the famous Euromaidan protests back in 2014. I just wonder how much that is something of a role model, I suppose, for people in Georgia, although also, of course, a cautionary tale based on what's happening in Ukraine today.
Georgian government and their propaganda has a very strong anti-Maidan narrative in Georgia. So it's generally like that sort of this Maidan mentioning is not really strongly present at the moment in the narrative because of the subsequent events that happened. And obviously there are a lot of similarities in the cases itself because Yanukovych back in Ukraine tried to go against its own people and derail from the European path. And Maidan was the result of this. And a very similar operation is happening. And all of these are orchestrated by Kremlin because it's not only happening in Georgia. If we look at what is happening in Armenia now, in Moldova, in Bosnia, in Serbia, all of these countries where Russia is trying to take away and capture the government, basically. So it's very similar. We see these patterns all over the place. And Maidan is obviously was the story of a successful fight that happened in Ukraine. Unfortunately, Belarus didn't do the same, and it failed. So we are afraid and of the similar scenario that happened in Belarus, but we also have this our own path, hopefully, which is going to be hopefully more successful than it was in Belarus or in the countries where democracy failed. And unfortunately, we are on the verge of failing democracy in Georgia.
And just finally, Georgie, I mean, in terms of the reasons for this, kind of what triggered this, the foreign agents law, just tell us a little more about that, either the law itself or, I mean, is the law itself the reason for this, or is this more about the European Union being the factor and sort of what might drive an association with the European Union?
I believe this is about changing the foreign policy course, and there's no other explanation where and why this law appeared again when last year, when it was rejected. The same people who are now leading this law, they were promising that this wouldn't be back on the table. And it happened really suddenly. No one expected it to be like so quickly, because they had another bill as well, which is anti-LGBT bill, also similar to what Russia is proposing all over the place. So it happened very abruptly, and obviously there were some expectations, but we believe that all of this is happening because they have instructions from Kremlin to derail from the pro-Western and pro-European path, and everything what they do, how they interact with the diplomats, or what language are they using against State Department representatives or against European Parliament, and generally like the West as a collective force, and how cautious they are against Russia. This all of this basically explains like what are they planning, and the plan is basically to derail Georgia from the pro-Western part and become a fully Kremlin satellite country, similar like Belarus, like Armenia was for years, and like Central Asian countries as well, who are also having their own struggles with Russia. So it's to look at it from the global perspective, we are experiencing, I believe, a Russian hybrid operation, which is on one side is fighting war in Ukraine, and on the other side is trying to capture all of these states from and take away from the Western influence.
Thanks very much, Georgi. That was Georgi Tabagari. Now here's Vincent McAvinney with today's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. Donald Trump's former personal attorney and fixer, Michael Cohen, will begin testifying against his former boss in New York City today. Mr. Cohen, who made the hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels at the center of the case, is expected to be the prosecution's star witness. A German high court has ruled that domestic security services could continue to treat the far-right Alternative for Deutschland party as a potentially extremist one. AfD, which is topping polls in several eastern states that hold elections later this year, has recently faced harsher scrutiny over racist remarks by members and allegations that it harbours spies and agents for Russia and China. And a large Japanese cedar tree said to resemble the popular character Totoro from Studio Ghibli's anime film My Neighbor Totoro has received an influx of visitors from Japan and abroad following the easing of COVID-19 restrictions last year. Said to be over 1,000 years old and at a height of about 20 metres, it has been cherished by locals as a tree of matchmaking and fertility. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Vincent. It's been only a few months since Ukraine replaced the head of its armed forces, and now it is Russia's turn for a reshuffle. Vladimir Putin is set to replace his defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, replaced by Deputy Prime Minister Andrei Belousov. Curiously, the move comes just as Russia appears to be regaining the initiative in its invasion of Ukraine. Well, joining me for more here in studio is Stephen Diao, Russia analyst and regular Monocle radio contributor. Good afternoon, Stephen.
Good afternoon, Chris.
Stephen, one of the reasons that struck me, at least reported, for this move that seemed a bit strange is runaway military spending. Is that really what this is about? Obviously, Russia is on a war footing. It is spending as much as it possibly can right now.
It is, but when they talk about runaway military spending, it's more a question of how much is being hived off into people's pockets, effectively. Mm. So what we've seen under Shoigu, who, it should be remembered, was a civilian too. Shoigu is not a military man, so the fact that Belousov is not from the military, he's an economist, that isn't the surprise. But what was happening under Shoigu after the war started was that a lot of business people and serious big business people who had lost their contracts because, of course, Russia can't do business with many Western countries, with the West. And so they were given military contracts, but at, shall we say, favourable terms. And if we think right back to the start of the war, of course, Putin thought it was going to be over in a few days and then got a shock when it wasn't and got a shock with the reaction of the West. And so it's ground on much, much longer than Putin expected. And what we've seen is that Shoigu has been doing favours to people by giving them these military contracts. And so although the military budget has become huge, and it's estimated that 40% of Russian GDP is now the military budget, this is a war budget already. But so much of that is being hived off because Russia lives on bribery and corruption. An interesting point now, and it's, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, we can look back, but a deputy defense minister, Timur Ivanov, was sacked recently for bribery. Mm. Now everyone knows that everyone's bribing everyone else. If everyone in Russia was in prison for bribery, Putin would be at the head of the queue. But that now we can see was a flagging up really for Shoigu. Look, you know, we're not going to imprison you, but we are going to remove you. And so put in your place this faceless bureaucrat. And it's very interesting. I've been reading a lot of Russian commentaries this morning, Russian commentators saying, many of them saying, and these are people who, you know, they are Russian, they follow this day to day, and the number one question has been, who? Belousov really is a colourless character, but what we know about him is he very much follows Putin's line. He very much follows the idea of let's return in many ways to the Soviet Union, the central control of the economy. And so what I think the crucial thing he's going to do here, or he's being expected to do, is cut down on these kickbacks to various people so that the military budget is being spent on the military. And if that is the case, this is bad news for Ukraine and the West.
Well, to that point, I guess, Stephen, is that then the central aspect of this for you? Is it such, has corruption become and these kickbacks become such a big problem that in Putin's mind they actually threaten his victory in Ukraine? And therefore, as you say, this is something that has been done for a long time. This is part of business there. The fact that he is now making this move, is that a sign that he feels this is the only way he's going to win?
It is partially that. But I think it's more to the point that it just shows how fixed Putin has now become on winning the war. He knows, he's known ever since those early days when it didn't go the way he wanted and he made various mistakes and the West reacted far more strongly than he expected and so on. He knows that he cannot afford to turn around and say, oh, I made a mistake. He can't bring an end to this. I mean, he could, in theory, he could bring an end to the war today. But he can't do that because he'd lose so much face. And he can't afford to lose face because if he loses face in Russia, he's not only out, he's dead. And so he's become totally fixated now. And again, this was a line I will give credit to Russian commentators, that they've picked up a phrase from the Second World War, the Great Patriotic War, as the Russians call it, and saying everything for the front, everything for victory. Now, in the Second World War, of course, that was very much, Russia had been invaded by Nazi Germany, and so that really rang true. But the fact they've picked up on that, this is Putin's fixation. He has to try and win this war. He cannot afford to back down. He cannot say that I made any mistakes.
But if this is a fixation of his, as you describe it, why then pick a relative unknown with no military experience? Surely that in itself could be a mistake that comes back to bite him.
No, I think that's a clever move because, one, it's in terms of what Belarus will be asked to do, it's all about the money. It's almost the economy, stupid.
So he does the money, and then the military commanders do the military.
Absolutely. It's the general staff, and the Lady Gerasimov, General Gerasimov, is still the head of the general staff. So they will very much be the ones who are deciding the military questions, and they will be going to Belousov and saying, we need the money for this. So he has a reputation as a solid economist in a rather Soviet way, but also he's a total Putin loyalist. He is known as the first person to back Putin over seizing Crimea in 2014. That's why he's so faceless, because he's completely in Putin's shadow. He does everything Putin wants him to do. So from that point of view, Putin thinks he's reliable. But if he can cut back on kickbacks, then that will be a way forward. And then, leave the military to do their job. An interesting point that, looking back to last year, of course, Prigozhin is no longer with us, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who had his private army, the Wagner Group. But he was so critical of Shoigu because he said Shoigu knew nothing about the military, and he was very insulting in his social media and so on. But that was also a sign that Shoigu wasn't a military man. He'd done very well as the emergency ministry's minister. So when there were earthquakes or landslides or whatever in Russia, he did that very well in the 1990s. He earned a reputation of actually being a really good guy. He's lost that reputation long since being defense minister. But he's not being moved out completely. That circle of people around Putin, they know so much about each other. They either have to be moved to another position or killed effectively because they have so many secrets. So he's being moved to the head of the Russian Security Council and given some responsibility for the military-industrial complex. So he's being kept in the fold, in the bosom of the family, because, as I say, they all know so much about each other. They often do that in Putin's time. But in terms of the war, it's a horrible thing to say in a way, but this, from the Russian point of view, is a good move.
Just very quickly, finally, Stephen, speaking of the war, though, this move towards Kharkiv that we are seeing today, is that Russia's new target, its biggest ambition to retake Kharkiv?
It probably is. it's too early to say. Really, it's only started 3 or 4 days ago. My feeling is that it was that they were going to do this, but they've actually gone for it quicker than we expected. I think because they now realise that with the Americans having given this $61 billion aid, which was held up for 6 months, and another $400 million worth of specifically military aid last Friday.
There's a window.
They think, well, and President Biden said, this has got to go in now, it's got to be quick. And I think they're thinking, well, you know, if they're sending in more artillery or more air defence, we've got less chance of attacking. If not Kharkiv, the city, they've been constantly attacking the city, but not seizing the city. But the more ground they get around it, the more they'll feel that they're protecting towns in Russia, like Belgorod, from attacks by Ukraine. So I think that's probably accelerated this particular military operation, although we did think it was coming anyway.
Stephen Diao, thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Chris Chermak. Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz is in Stockholm today for a summit with the 5 Nordic heads of state, marking the first time this constellation of leaders have come together, at least between them, since Sweden and Finland formally joined the NATO military alliance earlier this year. It comes after Scholz visited the Baltic nation of Lithuania last week for the deployment of Germany's first ever brigade on foreign soil, a sign that Germany is starting to lean into its role as a forward defender of NATO's front lines. While Bruno Kaufmann is the global democracy correspondent for the Swiss Broadcasting Company, he joins us from Stockholm. Bruno, good to have you on the show. The Nordics have always had pretty close defense cooperation. I wonder if, by way of setting up this summit, you could tell us how NATO membership has changed the way that they work together.
Yes, hello, Chris. That's correct. I mean, the Nordics have been close to each other, but in fact, they haven't had a common defense organization for almost 500 years, when there was this famous Kalmar Union between Denmark and Sweden, where Finland and Norway were basically parts of these kingdoms. But at this time, with NATO being spread all over the Nordic sphere, of course, now for the first time, the Nordic countries, and especially also Sweden, which have been neutral for more than 200 years, can now harvest on these political changes and really start to consolidate the position in the Nordic area of defense.
And what do they need to do that from Germany, or what would they like from Germany? What can they expect?
I mean, Germany is the most powerful neighbor to the south, and it's a natural partner, of course, for the Baltic Sea region. Again, this is a historic, reference also to the Hanseatic League, when German and Nordic cities were aligned across the Nordic sphere for trade and also for political coordination. And now these Nordic countries, together with the Baltic countries and Germany, of course, they can build a lot on building economic ties also for security, because this is a main issue of this summit, is about economic cooperation for security. So the defense industries, the innovative industries of this region should and want to work together much more strongly in order also to face, of course, Russia in the east.
Tell us more about that, this aspect, the private industry aspect, because that has been one of the key issues, certainly over the last few months, this talk that Europe needs to step up not only just general defense spending, but it needs to step up production, factories, weapons production, ammunition production. It is happening in places like Finland. Rheinmetall of Germany is also involved. But tell us more about that aspect of this summit.
Yes, here, I mean, the host country, Sweden, is, of course, coming in as a very powerful actor on this, because Sweden has had a very strong military industry for a very long time. Sweden builds air jets, Sweden builds submarines, Sweden builds a lot of artillery. And today, for dinner, the leaders of the Nordic countries and the German Chancellor will discuss how this can contribute to support Ukraine against Russia, because these countries together have a lot of, you can say, firepower, and they want to develop that much more. And now there are preconditions and there are political agreements on the ground which should allow this. And of course, they want to work together with private industries involved in that. And that's also the reason why the leaders will meet with leaders like from Ericsson, from Saab and other industries in Sweden.
And one other aspect, just in terms, there's the Nordic leaders meeting and this summit. There will also be a specific bilateral talks and a deal between Germany and Sweden. What can you tell us about that? How much of that, you know, how much of a sea change is that in Sweden's approach, reaching a sort of strategic innovation deal with Germany?
That's important. I mean, it's also a reorientation to this kind of Swedish-German alliance, which have been in many ways a little bit cut over many, many years after the Second World War, and also the distance, the political distance of Sweden first to the European Union and then to NATO. All these limitations are now over. And of course, when it comes to many industries, Sweden and Germany can cooperate and can benefit from each another, because Germany, of course, has a lot of industrial resources, which Sweden, as a much smaller country by population-wise, is lacking. But on the other side, and this is also going back to the old times, Sweden, of course, has a lot of resources, a lot of natural resources, which Germany is lacking. We see that, for instance, in the cooperation when it comes to these new battery mega factories, which are built now both in Sweden and in Germany. So there's a lot of cooperation going on. And tomorrow there will be an agreement between Sweden and Germany on developing these innovative industries, because as Ulf Christensen has said it at the start of the summit, I mean, the Nordic countries together with the Baltic, they are in fact economic-wise about the size of Russia, but they are much more innovative. And together with Germany, they want to even strengthen this feature of their development.
Bruno, thank you very much for joining us. That was Bruno Kaufmann here on Monocle Radio. You're listening to The Briefing. And finally, on today's show, we really cannot get enough of Eurovision here on Monocle Radio. So we do hope you'll indulge us for one more look back on the weekend that was. And that is because I'm delighted to say, fresh from Malmö, Monocle's senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Senior correspondent, that should read Eurovision correspondent still for this week, Faye. You join us right here in studio for a review of the 68th Eurovision Song Contest.
And Chris, it's important to say Eurovision is so important. You know, one of the things, I know I keep saying this, it's not a, I'm not saying anything radical.
I entirely agree. We have to get our listeners involved in this as well.
Exactly.
Surely they agree.
What a controversial take. But what a TV show. I mean, it's exciting. It's very long. It's about 4 hours and something. But to the end with the televoting, I love it. As a product, I think it's fantastic.
As a product, it is fantastic. It is always so much fun. But we do have to start, I think, this time especially with the fact that this really was quite a controversial one compared to past years. You were there. What was the mood like? The protests just outside. How did it feel? How different did it feel this time?
It's certainly the most controversial from the ones I've attended. You know, there's been previous problems, especially with Russian candidates since 2015. You know, there was a lot of booing on stage, but nothing of what I see in Malmö. In the queue to enter in the grand final on Saturday, there were protests literally by the arena. You know, there was, of course, the security barrier, but just outside there were people shouting. You know, it felt a little bit intimidating, you know, and it was quite interesting to see all the Swedish police officers with machine gun. I could see snipers on the top of all buildings. It was tense, but at the same time, you know, don't forget, it's Eurovision. A lot of people, they were having fun. So you have this weird contrast, people wearing all those outfits and cheering for their countries. Mm. And then, you know, people perhaps sometimes with you know, valid questions, you know, about certain politics from the EBU this year.
It was interesting when you mentioned Russia as well, because I was at Vienna's Eurovision Song Contest back in 2015. That was pretty charged as well, I have to say, when Russia was starting to almost win the competition that year. There was a real feeling of tension. But this one, I mean, how much did this one also reach the inside as opposed to the protest outside? How much did you feel it within the stadium?
Well, within the stadium. So, for example, when the Israeli contestant was performing or even mentioned with points, there was quite a lot of booing. But at the same time, there was part of the crowd that actually was clapping, and they're not necessarily Israelis. So I can honestly say there was a divisive thing, and you can see that from the televoting. At the same time, that there's people that would definitely think Israel shouldn't be there on a year like today, but there are people that think the opposite.
And they got a very, very healthy share of the public vote.
And I think that was definitely political. That was a sign say, you know what, I think Israel should be here. So that's why I think opinions were contrasting. So I know we always talk about Eurovision is political. Most of the time, I genuinely think people vote for the better song. But sometimes politics, it's inevitable. Eurovision is political. We saw that with Ukraine in 2022, even though that was an amazing song, Stefania. I think you could have won even without the conflict. But yeah, it is political, it's inevitable.
Well, let's move on then from the politics. When you say they always pick the right song, let's have one little clip one more time of the winning song. So, Faye, some people some people I spoke to could not get away from the outfit and therefore almost lost track of the song. What did you think of it?
Nemo made history. I mean, not my favorite song at the beginning. Nemo, you know, the first non-binary artist at Eurovision. I think it's fun to talk about the positive things as well. We're still having firsts on Eurovision. And by the way, the core movement Nemo was doing in his at their performance.
The staging was quite
incredible. The staging was incredible. The production designer of the show told me that was the most challenging one to make. You need a very good core to do that. And the song is growing on me. I mean, it's doing very well with the Spotify global charts. And actually, that's something interesting, Chris. Not necessarily the winning song end up being the most successful. Do you remember Rosalyn with Snap? She was representing Armenia, I believe, 2 years ago. She was 20th, so didn't do very well. But then the song became a viral hit.
Oh,
and that was the second most popular Eurovision track of all time.
I remember that being with a Dutch track as well. There was a country Dutch track that did extremely well in the charts, but not so well on the actual day.
Maybe Austria, you know, which I know we both like it. It didn't do very well.
Poor Austria, my home country of Austria, did not do very well. You liked it very much. I don't know if you gave it the death knell or something like that, Faye, by mentioning Austria. Poor Austria.
Poor Austria.
But we did want to get to one that was a very big one that we haven't yet talked about on this show last week either. And this one, I personally as well, I just thought was an extremely strong performance. Slimane from France. Let's have a little listen to him.
Bravo, bravo. I mean, incredible performance.
Incredible. He stepped away from the mic at that point to deliver that performance. It was just an incredible moment, as you were just pointing. Goosebumps.
Goosebumps. He was showing off his voice, and he's right to do that. One interesting thing about Slimane, I was looking at the numbers. He was fourth overall, right? Which is very, very valid, very good position. But I think the jury and the televoting liked him, you know? So there's been some, for example, Nemo did very well with the jury. With the public, did well as well.
Okay,
fourth.
But not quite as well, yeah.
But I think Slimane was good on both. And very deservedly so. And he did try to be a little bit political, but in a very delicate way, talking about peace. He managed to do that because there were a lot of restrictions about this, but I think he managed.
There were a couple of artists that just mentioned peace, didn't they? That was the one way to get
Portugal
as well.
Very interesting there.
Just before we let you go, a final word on the hosts, Fernando. We do have to talk about this, particularly though, given that it was Sweden. Sweden knows how to put on a show, and they did sort of present with some of their best.
They did. I mean, Petra Mede is back. She was the host in 2013, in 2016, and 2024. Yeah, I almost forgot which year we were right now. Exactly. But she's amazing. She's funny. And the Swedes, they have a history of Eurovision, so they can make fun of themselves as well. They have an amazing, you know, pop history. I will miss Petra. And I think it's so important to have a good host. That's the secret of success of a good Eurovision, in my opinion.
A good host, although they can also be quirky and kind of,
yes,
people can be sort of laughing with and at them at the same time. That's also part of what Eurovision is about, isn't it?
Absolutely. When she was making fun of Alcazar, who was returning with crying at the discotheque, everybody was thinking it was going to be ABBA. Not quite. And she made fun of them. Well, they accept any bottle of wine for this performance.
That
funny.
Was a good moment, although it was at the same time disappointing that then ABBA did not show up and they simply went to the avatars of ABBA afterwards.
Come on, ABBA. They should have been there. You
they
know,
should have. 50 years?
I can't understand. And I'm tired of those. What's the name of the avatars, right? I want the real thing.
We want the real thing. Next time, Faye, maybe we'll get the real thing. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you very much for joining us. That's all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Vincent McAvini. Our researcher was George Ruskin, and our studio manager was Christy O'Grady. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.